Wow, thank you so much for the warm welcome. It's wonderful to be with you here at the Vineyard Leaders Gathering. And as Andrew said, I have been hosting conversations on faith for nearly two decades, and it's been an amazing experience. And I hope to share this morning with you some of what I've learned in the process of doing that, some of the ways in which I've seen the conversation change quite significantly in recent years as well, and what that may help us as the church to do when it comes to engaging our culture and the kinds of questions our culture is asking of us. Andrew kindly mentioned the title of my new book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And I begin the book by quoting from a well-known poem by the Victorian poet Matthew Arnold. It's titled Dover Beach, and this poem was written about 150 years ago. And there's this well-known stanza in the poem that says, "The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled, but now I only hear its melancholy, long-withdrawing roar." Now, in Matthew Arnold's day, the melancholy, long-withdrawing roar of the sea of faith stood for the way in which science and technology had increasingly come in his day, was seeing faith go out on the tide. And if you like, that has only increased in the 150 years since he wrote that poem. We've seen increasing secularization in the West. We live in a very post-Christian age now. More and more people say they don't claim any kind of religion. The church-going statistics have been on the decline in Europe and the UK and the West generally for many years. So it's no surprise that a lot of people say, well, religion is on its way out. Secularism is the new reality in the West. And lots of people, not least a group of people called the New Atheists, who I'll come on to in a moment, have spoken about essentially the death of God in that way. But a few years ago, I had a conversation with an interesting person that made me rethink this whole image of the sea of faith going out on the tide. Douglas Murray, if you haven't heard of him, is a really interesting thinker. He's quite a conservative thinker. He's the associate editor of The Spectator magazine. We were actually contemporaries at Oxford University, but he's gone on to this very high-profile career speaking into culture and politics and so on. Now, Douglas Murray is not a person of faith, but when I invited him on for a conversation with New Testament theologian N.T. Wright a couple of years ago, he described himself as a Christian atheist. A Christian atheist. Now, it sounds like a contradiction in terms, doesn't it? But what he meant by that was that while he doesn't believe in Christianity, he nevertheless has recognized increasingly in the last few years that everything he actually does believe in terms of human rights, equality, dignity, was essentially given to him by the Judeo-Christian heritage of the West. So he's adopted this phrase, "I am a Christian atheist." And he talked about this idea of Matthew Arnold's, that the sea of faith has gone out. And he said to me, well, the interesting thing about the sea of faith, Justin, is that it could come back in again. That's the point of tides, right? And that got me thinking, actually. I think Douglas Murray might be onto something. In fact, that was the catalyst, really, for this book. Because the other thing that Douglas Murray mentioned in this conversation was that he had been surprised to see a number of his contemporary secular peers, thinking, rational 21st century people, actually coming to faith. Now, not a flood of people, but enough to make him sit up and take notice. And he wondered whether there might be something changing in the atmosphere. Perhaps, he said, the church has an opportunity to speak into a more receptive crowd. And I think Douglas Murray is right, because I'd been noticing the same thing myself. Some surprising stories of people as thinking, rational 21st century adults coming to faith against all their and my expectations. And I'd also noticed something else, a real change in the tone of the conversations that were being held. So I began hosting faith debates between Christians and atheists around the mid-2000s. And this was a time when something called the New Atheism was really gaining a head of steam. The New Atheism was led by the so-called Four Horsemen of the New Atheism. There they are on the screen. Richard Dawkins on the far left, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and Dan Dennett. Now, They're all kind of public intellectuals, and each of them had written a best-selling anti-God book, perhaps best known Richard Dawkins and his book, The God Delusion. In fact, two of these have passed away since, Christopher Hitchens in 2011, and only very recently, only last week, Daniel Dennett on the far right of the picture. But these were the figureheads, if you like, of this new atheist movement. And this was a very dogmatic, quite aggressive form of public atheism. It had a lot of column inches, a lot of sort of cultural commentary going on around it. There were some quite big campaigns. I don't know if anyone remembers the Atheist Bus Campaign in 2009, where we had red London buses circulating the capital, bearing the slogan, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." So this was the closest thing atheism had ever had to an advertising campaign. And you had similar things in the US, like the Reason Rally in Washington, you know, tens of thousands of people descending on the mall to kind of champion science and reason and chant these slogans, you know. So it was a really interesting moment. And what marked out new atheism as different, say, from the old atheism, was that it was very disparaging and dismissive of religion. Religion was just a fairy tale that we needed to consign to history as science and reason told us about a bright new future. Now, the conversations I was hosting on Unbelievable tended to reflect what was happening in the culture at that time. There's a couple of pictures of me speaking on the show. It was a great time to be having these conversations because these issues were very much in the public sphere. And I was finding that, you know, I was having a lot of conversations between quite dogmatic atheists and Christian thinkers. But over time, I noticed that the conversations began to change. And on the screen there, you can see a conversation I hosted in 2018, which is really when I mark the beginning of this transition. And this was an interesting one for me, because rather than having a Christian versus an atheist, in this occasion, I actually had two non-believers joining me on the show, but very different types of non-believers. On the left of the picture, you can see Susan Blackmore, who's an atheist psychologist. And on the right of the picture, a man called Jordan Peterson, who some of you may have heard of. He's a Canadian psychologist, and I'll come to him more later. But they were debating the question, do we need God to make sense of life, for a purpose in life? And actually, Jordan Peterson, even as a non-Christian, was the one defending the idea that actually we do need something like God to make sense of life. Now, this was a very different kind of conversation to the ones I'd been having up to this point with the normal kinds of new atheists who were joining me. And increasingly, I'd been noticing, actually, there was a change in the way many people who didn't necessarily think of themselves as Christians were actually choosing to present themselves. Very often, the non-believers who were coming on the show were distancing themselves from this new atheist movement, saying, I'm not a Richard Dawkins sort of atheist. And were actually far more open, again, even while they weren't believers, to acknowledging that there was a value to Christian faith. And during the course of my talk, I want to introduce you to some of these people. But what it signaled to me was that there was a change in the tone. Something had switched in the culture. And I think really what had begun to happen was that the nature of the conversations had started to change because people, I think, had ultimately started to tire of the new atheism itself. It had sort of become so brash and zealous in itself, it was almost taking on a quasi-religious tone to it. You know, the four horsemen were the high priests, in a sense, of this movement. They had their religious texts themselves, which were their best-selling books. They had a sort of materialist creed that all that exists is matter in motion, that everything we experience can be boiled down to the blind forces of nature. And anyone who disagreed with that materialist orthodoxy was rounded upon as a heretic. So it gained a kind of quasi-religious sort of fundamentalism itself. And I think a lot of people started to see that that's ultimately what people had done. They'd replaced one form of religion with another form of religion. But more than that, actually, the movement itself started to unravel internally. There's a much longer story you could trace again in the book of how this happened. But I was sort of an interested bystander, seeing that the new atheist movement itself started to get all these internal fractures. Because the fact was that a lot of people ended up not being happy with the fact that this movement was essentially represented by a phalanx of old white men. And they said, we need more diversity in the movement. And in fact, one part of the movement said, we are going to rebrand ourselves. We want to be atheism plus. We're going to be atheist plus a commitment to gender equality and to feminism and to LGBT rights. But another part of the movement said, we want nothing to do with that because all we're interested in is science and reason. Okay, we don't need any politically correct ideologies. And there was a sort of huge split in the movement at this point, to the point where many of these atheist sort of architects of the movement fell out with each other quite dramatically, far more dramatically than they'd ever fallen out with their Christian counterparts. And what that led to was a split in the movement, to the point where even Richard Dawkins himself got stripped of his American Atheist of the Year award by the, by the Humanist Association of America in 2021. Why did he get stripped of his award? Because of what he'd been saying about transgender. And these were the issues that divided the atheist community. To boil it down, once they had agreed that God didn't exist and religion was bad for you, they couldn't agree on anything else. And what I found was that this was the problem overall with the atheist movement. It was essentially predicated on a negative statement, what we do not believe in. But people can't exist, can't live their lives on a purely negative statement. They need something positive, a positive ethic to live for. And it failed to provide that because science and reason are great for some things, but they won't tell you what the point of life is. They won't tell you how you should live your life. And that was the point at which they disagreed. So I found that increasingly, by the time sort of 2017, 2018, I just found the conversations were changing. People had seen this new atheist sort of phase had really waned by that point. And there were far more people I was bumping into who, as I say, were not Christians, but were these secular intellectuals who were open again to the value of faith. As I say, I cover these issues in the new book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. But my first book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, was really my case for faith at the point of having hosted these conversations at about the 10-year mark. And while I make the case for faith in the blue book, as it were, this new book is really about how I think the church can take that faith, that story, to a culture that desperately needs to hear it again. And with the new podcast series that I've recently launched, I'm able to kind of in real time tell some of these stories that I want to share with you today about people I'm finding who are rediscovering the Christian story, even in our post-Christian age. I want to draw the stories out through sort of three different ways of looking at it, three ways in which I think God speaks to various questions: the question of human existence, the question of human value, and the question of human purpose. Firstly, I think some of these thinkers are pointing us back to the fact that God makes sense of human existence. And I'm going to get a bit scientific on you at this point, because there is this very familiar mantra that came with the new atheists. Much of the movement was led by scientific thinkers like Richard Dawkins. And it was essentially this: the more we know about science, the less reason we have to believe in God. That was the direction of travel. The more we know about the universe, the less reason we have to believe in God. But I think there's a very different, an alternative story of science to be told. Because I think the direction of travel has actually been in precisely the opposite direction. Because I've been bumping into more and more scientific thinkers who are telling me, actually, there's something going on in the universe that simply doesn't make sense on this purely naturalistic account of everything. One of the phenomenal things that I discovered early on in hosting these debates on science and the universe and God was a phenomenon called the fine-tuning of the universe for life. Now, it's a bit of a kind of mind-bending subject, but basically, when the universe came into existence, which is itself a rather fascinating fact, it was birthed with a set of values and fundamental constants that had to be just as they are in order for life to be able to develop at some point in the cosmos. So take, for instance, the force of gravity, the thing that sticks our feet to the ground and stops us all floating off into space. If that differed from its actual value by one part in 10 to the 60, that's a one with 60 zeros after it, if it just differed one way or the other by that tiny, tiny, tiny fractional value, then you and I wouldn't exist. We would not live in a universe that was capable of sustaining life, because if it was any weaker, then everything would fly out too far before galaxies and stars and chemistry could develop. If any stronger, everything would collapse back in on itself, and again, no life. But it happened to hit just the right value for you and I to be able to exist. And that's just one of about 30 similar and far more finely tuned numbers and constants. Now, it's not just me as a Christian thinker and apologist saying this. It's lots of non-Christian scientists and thinkers. So one of the people I want to introduce you to is Paul Davies. He's my first secular thinker, saying fascinating things about God. He's a physicist, a science popularizer based at the Arizona State University. He's been a bit of a thorn in the side of the new atheist because he's always pointing out the way that the universe always sort of surprises us when it comes to the fact we're here. He's written extensively on how things like the fact that there is a universe at all is quite surprising. Big Bang cosmology suggests that the universe came into existence about 13.8 billion years ago, and that leaves a huge question mark about sort of, well, what caused the universe to be here in the first place? He's also written and spoken at length about this fine-tuning of the universe for life. And thirdly, he's talked about the fact of life itself, what it took for the first DNA molecule to come together, and just the mind-boggling chemical complexity required for that to happen. And more than that, he then talks about the fact we can even talk about this, that we have the consciousness and the comprehension to just make sense of all of this with just, you know, this gray matter between our skulls. He says it borders on the miraculous. In fact, here's how he put it to me. He says the directionality in the universe going from matter to life to consciousness. He said, I would add comprehension to that. He said, there's an arrow of time in the direction of comprehension. And he says, if that is the case, if this is not just an enormous fluke, a happy series of accidents, then that to me comes very close to something like a purpose in nature. I think that's a sort of religious feeling, he says, what Einstein called a cosmic religious feeling. Now, Paul Davies doesn't like to use the word God. But when I hear him talk about this idea of a directionality in the universe from sort of chaos to order to consciousness, it reminds me of another word, a Greek word, logos. It's a word that speaks of order being spoken into chaos. We get the English word logic from it. And of course, it's the word used to describe Jesus Christ, the pre-existing word that speaks life into being. And when I see science, the best scientists, coming up with something that sounds an awful lot like what is written down in the first chapter of John's Gospel, I think something interesting is going on in our culture. Something's happening that is actually very much in contrast to the story we've often been told in popular culture about science and faith. So that's just one little kind of moment, as it were, a little kind of indication of what's going on in that area, in science. The fact you and I exist, I think, makes better sense with the God explanation than the atheist explanation. And I think it's interesting to see secular thinkers reminding us of that. But there's another important area, human value. I think God makes sense of human value. Why do we believe in the idea of human rights, human dignity? Why do we believe that there are some very real rules about how we should and shouldn't treat people? Is it just a result of science and reason? Is it just some kind of evolutionary social contract that we've come to? I don't think so. I don't think that really gets to the nub of why we believe in human morality, dignity, human rights. And this was really brought home to me in a conversation I had several years ago with Richard Dawkins himself. I was at a University of Oxford debate between him and a well-known Christian thinker called John Lennox. I managed to get just 10 minutes afterwards with him, with my microphone, to record a quick conversation on what they had discussed. And this was a really interesting moment. I'm going to read it to you verbatim of how our conversation went on the subject of human morality. I said to him, but if we'd evolved into a society where rape was considered fine, would that mean that rape is fine? and you said that I don't want to answer that question. It's enough for me to say that we live in a society where it's not considered fine. We live in a society where selfishness, failure to pay your debts, failure to reciprocate favours is regarded askance. That is the society in which we live. I'm very glad, that's a value judgment, glad that I live in such a society. And I responded, but when you make a value judgment, don't you yourself immediately step outside of this evolutionary process and say the reason that this is good is that it's good? And you don't have any way to stand on that statement. And he replied, well, my value judgment itself could come from my evolutionary past. And I said, so therefore, it's just as random in a sense as any product of evolution. And he said, you could say that, but in any case, nothing about it makes it more probable that there's anything supernatural. And I said, okay, but ultimately, your belief that rape is wrong is as arbitrary as the fact we've developed five fingers rather than six. And he said, you could say that, yes. And you could say that. And in fact, I think you should say that if you are a thoroughgoing naturalist atheist like Richard Dawkins. So why do we instinctively recoil at the idea that our belief that rape is wrong is just the happenstance of the hand that evolution happens to have dealt us at this moment, this time and place? Why do we actually believe, no, there's something different about that? There are really right and wrong ways to treat other human beings. I can't find a better explanation than the one you find at the first page of the book of Genesis. It says there that God created humans in his own image, male and female, he created them. If that's true, if every human being is made in the image of God, that gives every human being on the face of the planet inestimable worth, inestimable value. That makes perfect sense of why we have this belief in human rights, equality, value, and dignity. It can't be grounded in a non-guided, unpurposed process of evolution where you could have come up with some very different ways of thinking about value. And indeed, many cultures do think differently about human value, and many cultures in the past have thought very differently about human value. But this has been brought home most to me by another non-Christian thinker or a secular intellectual who arguably is going on something of an interesting spiritual journey. He's called Tom Holland. He's not the Spider-Man actor. He is the historian Tom Holland. Many of you may know him from his really popular The Rest is History podcast that he co-hosts with Dominic Sambrook. And he wrote a best-selling book in 2019 called Dominion, and it really sketched out his thesis of the way in which he sees the Christian story has essentially completely shaped the moral instincts of the West. Tom himself has an interesting story of sort of having been raised in a sort of nominally religious environment, but any faith he had sputtered out by his teenage years. But as he progressed into a career sort of writing histories, popular histories of the ancient Greeks and Romans, the more time he spent in the sandals of the Greco-Roman world, the more he realized just how alien all their values and practices were to his own as a 21st century Western person. Because what he found there was a world where slavery, for instance, was an unquestioned part of the economy. It was just the de facto way people existed in that world. Slavery was a given. The lives of women and children were cheap. Certain people could be treated as sexual property. Newborn children could be left to die in the wild if they were unwanted. The slaughter and enslaving of your enemies was a cause of great triumph and not considered a form of genocide. He realized that all his own beliefs about human dignity and equality, compassion and freedom, they didn't come from the Greeks and the Romans. And they didn't come from science and atheism and the Enlightenment either. He realized they came from a very, very specific source, a person called Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And that Christian revolution 2,000 years ago had completely shaped in every way the world that he now lived in. So that Tom Holland could say, even though I don't believe in Christianity, in almost every way I am a Christian in terms of the things I believe about life and about humanity and about value. And he has been pointing this out to lots of his secular peers. Another fascinating secular thinker who's recently emerged is Louise Perry. She's the author of a book called The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. And she's got a similarish story of growing up as a sort of enlightened, typical, liberal 21st century person, especially when it came to her views on sex and relationships. But it was the experience of working in a rape crisis centre that convinced Louise Perry that actually something had gone deeply wrong in the sexual revolution. She realised actually that our kind of, the freedom and sort of, you know, promiscuity that essentially characterises the sexual revolution of the 60s onwards had actually been really bad news for women. And she took a very sort of scientific, socio-evolutionary approach in her book to this question. But the remarkable thing is, in the process of doing that, she came to remarkably Christian conclusions. She realized there is one institution that has essentially, for better or worse, basically been the model by which societies, individuals, and cultures have flourished, and it's called monogamous marriage. And she presented this to her readers as something they ought to consider again. Now, the interesting thing is that I've been privileged to have conversations, a number of conversations, both with Tom Holland and Louise Perry, and they've both come to intellectually appreciate the values that Christianity gave to the West. They're both, interestingly, on interesting spiritual journeys as well. What's interested them intellectually has also started, I think, to draw them spiritually. But that's another sort of story to tell, and you'll hear some of that if you go and listen to the podcast or read the book. Ultimately, though, what I find in these secular intellectuals suddenly rediscovering the values that Christianity gave us and just why we might want to think about them again is that it points back to the value that we find right there on the first page of Scripture, that ultimately we can only make sense of this idea of human value and dignity if it's true that we're made in the image of God. And I'm excited to see the way that many secular intellectuals are starting to point people back to that reality again. Finally, I think God makes sense of human purpose. I think God is the best explanation of the why question. One of the most prominent thinkers in this area is the person I mentioned earlier, Jordan Peterson, this Canadian psychology professor who really kind of blew up in terms of public awareness in 2018, somehow filling auditoriums of thousands with especially young men coming to listen to him speak on the Bible, on the Bible, like 2 or 3 hour lectures on the book of Genesis, people paying to come along. I mean, this is like a preacher's dream, right? I mean, this is the exact demographic that we often feel is lacking in so many churches, coming to listen for 2 or 3 hours at a time. What was going on? I was fascinated when I started to hear stories emerging of this person. Now, Peterson is, admittedly, a bit of a controversial character, something of a Marmite figure. You either love him or hate him often. But whatever you think of his sort of politics, there's no doubt that he's been having an outsized influence on a huge demographic. There are millions of people who follow his YouTube channel, listen to his podcast, turn up to his lectures around the world. And Peterson himself is sort of very much a peer of the new atheist thinkers. He's in that sort of arena. He was having these huge arena debates with people like Sam Harris. You know, you could go to the O2 and they filled it twice with these discussions on whether faith is relevant to modern culture. Peterson himself is very critical of the new atheists. He said, we need a story to live by, and the new atheists failed to give people a story to live by. And I think that's at the core of this. Why are so many people turning up to hear a Canadian psychologist talk to them about meaning, purpose, and identity? It's because people are looking for meaning, purpose, and identity in our culture today. Why are they looking for it? Because they've lost it. Why have they lost it? Because we've lost the story that once gave it to people. Whether they realized it or not, this funny old story of Christianity, which has a beginning, God created you for a purpose, has a middle, you exist, and though your life is tough, God has come in person to be with you in the midst of that struggle, died for you, and it has an end because of his resurrection. You can be part of this new life, this eternal hope. Whether people realized it or not, that was the story that framed their lives. It was the story that gave their lives meaning. It gave them a purpose. It gave them an identity. But as that story has been pushed to the background gone into the back mirror in Western culture. People still need a story to live by. The psychologists tell us we are storytelling creatures. We need something to make sense of life. And the new atheists fail to give people a better story to live by. So what we see happening in our culture, and I think what Jordan Peterson is often pointing to, is the fact that we're grabbing onto all kinds of other quasi-religious stories. It may be things around sexuality and gender identity. That becomes maybe someone's sacred story. That becomes the thing that fills the God-shaped hole. It may be some kind of political nationalism, some kind of right-wing sort of political story that becomes the new story of reality. But the problem is, these stories were never meant to take the place of the Christian story. These stories end up just butting up against each other and create something called the culture wars on Twitter. And the problem is, the reason we're in the middle of this polarized, tribalistic age is because we need a better story to live by. These stories aren't doing the job. And so when I see Jordan Peterson come and say, hey, everyone, there is this book that we used to read. There is this story we used to believe. It might be worth taking a second look at it again. And it's extraordinary to see the effect that's had on so many people. I've met many people who, even though Peterson himself seems to kind of waver on the whole God question, I've met many people for whom he has opened a door to Christian faith, and they've walked through it. They've suddenly been able to take faith seriously again, because here's someone kind of speaking their language. And I would describe Peterson as a sort of prophet from outside the church who is suddenly making it possible for people to take faith seriously again. I mean, as I say, lots of ink has been spilled over where exactly Jordan Peterson sits on the faith question. It's interesting because his wife, Tammy, recently got confirmed in the Catholic Church. His daughter, Michaela, has become a Christian. So it feels like the net is closing in a bit on him. He's having lots of conversations with lots of Christian thinkers. What was interesting was one conversation he had after sort of during recuperation from a long period of illness. In 2021, he had a remarkable conversation with an Eastern Orthodox thinker called Jonathan Pageau. And Peterson, as he often does, struggled to contain his emotions as he spoke of his religious longings. Almost in tears, he describes a kind of growing comprehension that the objective world of history and facts that he believed in, and also what he describes as the narrative world of meaning and symbolism, which he's very invested in as a psychologist. He said he could never reconcile these two worlds, but suddenly he started to say that maybe those two worlds can live together, the objective world of history and fact, the imaginative world of meaning and emotion. He said, you know where I'm finding that those two converge? It's in the person of Jesus Christ. And he said, I'm amazed at my own belief and I don't understand it. And it's not just Jordan Peterson that I'm seeing this kind of quest for meaning and purpose sort of appearing in the life of. There was a fascinating thing that happened at the end of last year. So I published the book in September. And as happens with a book, you can kind of give the examples you can give and give the story up to that point, and then it's published. But what I've included since in my new podcast is the fascinating story of Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Now, in November, she published an article online called Why I Am Now a Christian. Now, that may not be so very remarkable, except for who Ayaan Hirsi Ali is. Because Ayaan Hirsi Ali, up to that point, was probably the most famous female atheist in the world. She was very much part of the new atheists in the mid-2000s. Her own story was one of escaping a kind of abusive fundamentalist Islamic upbringing in Somalia, finding freedom in the West, becoming a sort of public thinker and politician, and very much joining in the new atheist sort of movement in the early 2000s. She published her own best-selling book called Infidel. But something has changed in the last few years for Ayaan Hirsi Ali, as she explains in the article. She talks about the fact that she came to see that atheism simply could not provide the kind of foundations for morality, justice, meaning, and purpose that we need. It was quite a kind of political article, because she talked about the fact that she fears that some of the big hegemonic political influences in the world, China, Russia, fundamentalist Islam, that secular atheism cannot provide a kind of bulwark against those. And she recognized, again, with Tom Holland's help reading his book, that it was really Christianity that had provided the foundation for the things she believed in. But more than that, it wasn't just a kind of cultural, political issue. She said that she found that she had experienced a meaning crisis in her life. She needed a purpose for living. And in a subsequent interview, fascinating interview, she told of how she got to the point where she was undergoing regular counseling, therapy, and she got to a point where she had been drinking quite heavily, she'd been experiencing extreme depression, and her counselor asked her, her counselor actually told her, "I think you're spiritually bankrupt, Ayan." And she said, "Well, I can't believe in God because the God I was raised with was a monster." And her counselor said, "Well, what kind of God do you think you could believe in?" And Ayan said, "I started to describe the kind of God I might be willing to believe in. And as I described that God, I realized I was describing Jesus Christ." And so she said, "So I thought, well, maybe I don't need to invent a God. Maybe I'll investigate this person." And she did, and she has been going to church. Now, I don't know exactly where she is in her journey. That's between her and God. But something significant has changed to the most famous female atheist in the world. That suggests something is happening in our culture, something very significant. I feel like there's a turning of the tide. This isn't a sort of massive, everyone's filling the churches, we're all overflowing with people. No, but something has changed in the atmosphere. That sea of faith that is supposedly going out and will never come back in, I think we're starting to see a turning of the tide. People can only exist on the thin diet of secular materialism for so long before they need a good, better, true story to live by. And I think we're seeing that happening in our culture. I just want to finish with one more story, fascinating one, because in the end, I do believe that whether it's me, you, Jordan Peterson, Ayan Hirsi Ali, we all need a better story to live by. And that story was shown in person by Jesus Christ. I think we have really good reason to believe that all our deepest longings inside are fulfilled in him, that all of the complexity and design we see in the universe was spoken into existence by the divine logos, and that search for purpose and meaning and identity is only fulfilled when we find our identity in Jesus. And the person I want to finish with on this is a woman called Molly Worthen. Molly is a noted historian of North American religion, and I've had the privilege of interviewing her recently about her own journey. She's based at the University of North Carolina, and for the past 20 years or so, she has been an agnostic, researching US religion from the sidelines and also writing for well-known publications like the New York Times and the Atlantic. Now, the interesting thing is that after 20 years as an agnostic, in the summer of 2022, Molly Worthen was baptized. And you might ask, why on earth would that happen to Molly Worthen? Because if anyone knew the good, the bad, and the ugly of religion, it was her. She had been reporting on it for so long. But what happened was that she was sent on assignment to speak to a megachurch pastor in North Carolina, J.D. Greer. And she was doing a profile on him for a magazine. And once they'd had a couple of interviews, he kind of challenged Molly to get off the agnostic fence. He said, "Well, what do you actually believe about Jesus of Nazareth?" And she said, "Well, I guess I've never quite made my mind up. You know, I've kind of heard that we can't really be sure that the things in the New Testament really happened. It's all a bit fuzzy." And he said, "Well, why don't you go and actually look into it? Do some homework." He challenged her. And so she thought, "Well, okay, I can do that. I can do some homework." In fact, he put her in touch with some really interesting people, someone who's passed away since, but Tim Keller, well-known Christian thinker who wrote books like The Reason for God. And also New Testament historian N.T. Wright, Tom Wright. And she started to read some of their books, and she became fascinated. Suddenly, she was emailing these folks and having conversations. And what she discovered in the process was that there was far more interesting and compelling evidence for the person of Jesus Christ than she had ever realized. What she realized was that Christianity isn't just a set of propositions and a kind of a set of good moral advice for living your life. It was based in a very real set of historical circumstances. Something happened, she realized, 2,000 years ago, that meant that a whole group of Jewish people started claiming that the Jewish Messiah had come, been crucified, and been raised to life again, against all of their theological expectations. She realized that something had happened 2,000 years ago, and that there was this resurrection-shaped hole at the center of the story. Now, Molly will say, I couldn't 100% prove this, but other things that were happening in her life made her realize that she needed a better story to live by. There were lots of things she was struggling to make sense of as a sort of agnostic. And so she came to the point where she said, you know what? I've still got some doubts. I still haven't made sense of everything in the Bible. But she said, I think I can believe what it says there, that when you believe with your heart and confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord, that you will be saved. And that's what she did. And she was baptized that summer in that megachurch against all of her expectations. She became a Christian. And if it can happen to Molly Worthen, I think it can happen to anyone. I think there's this fascinating new openness in our culture. People are desperate for a better story to believe in. And we have a story that they can't, that not only can they believe in, they can look into, that has this historical credibility that not only makes sense of history, it makes sense of us, in our deepest longings and desires. I'm excited by this. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to suddenly see our churches run over with meaning-seeking millennials and Gen Z, but I do sense that this is a moment where the church can be speaking into our culture in a different way. Sometimes the problem is we're a bit behind the culture, and we think that they're still asking the questions that the new atheists were asking some 15 or 20 years ago. But actually, I don't think most people wake up in the morning and ask, is there a God? Someone show me some philosophical evidence. They wake up and they ask, what's the point of life today? Is there a reason for me to get out of bed? Because we're living in a culture where people are desperate for a meaning, a purpose, and an identity. And we're here to show them that there is a story that they can put their faith in, that there's a story they can step into. We need to make sure we know that story, and we know how to tell that story compellingly to people who are open to it again. I do believe there is a new openness to this story, and that God is calling us all in our generation to say, who are the meaning seekers? Who are these people who might be just standing on the edges, waiting for an invitation to be invited into this story again? That's an enormous privilege, an enormous challenge. And I pray that in your life, in your church, you would see God move and respond to those who are waiting for that invitation. God bless you all. Thank you.